We're going to talk about crossing the geography bridge and get a general idea of the physical layout of Palestine. The events of the Bible took place between four great bodies of water: the southwest, or the Mediterranean, the north, the Black Sea, southeast, Persian Gulf, northeast, Caspian Sea. So you can take this area, make a triangle, and say there is where all of God's revelation was made. All of God's truth that He communicated to man was made within these four areas. In terms of size, if you go roughly east to west, you're looking at 1,400 miles. If you go north to south, you're looking at roughly 900 miles. So in that area, you have the biblical world. Now, you've got to think of it in another step. Most of this, or a big portion of this, is pure desert. So if we go down to the southern area right in here, you are in desert. And extends, really we should bring it over further, over to the Nile. Desert extends from the Nile all the way across to the Persian Gulf. This desert area. Let's see if we can highlight Palestine a little bit here. Well, we'll highlight it a minute. Now, across this area is what is often called the Fertile Crescent. Israel is literally the center of the world in many, many ways, connecting all of the major continents as a highway where they pass through, and we'll see that in a minute. Now, if we overlay this, then I'm putting on to this the Fertile Crescent. And that means starting down at the Persian Gulf, up the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, on up north, and coming down through Palestine, right in here, down to the Nile and along the Nile Valley. That is, again, the Fertile Crescent. Biblically speaking, the part of the Fertile Crescent, or the part of the valley that goes into the Nile, this little strip, and it should cover over the Nile, this little strip was literally the only place in Egypt that you could farm anything. If the Nile overflowed as it did once a year, how far it overflows determines your crops. If it doesn't overflow, Nile, it's dead. Consequently, the Nile became very focal in Egypt, and everything connected with it became significant. There's a book you ought to read by Davis called Moses and the Gods of Egypt. It's a commentary on the book of Exodus. And in that commentary, he points out how that the plagues brought on Egypt were literally Yahweh God declaring war on the gods of Egypt. And if you were in a land that was dependent upon the overflow of the Nile and the silt that it left, Nile would become God. And it was no insignificant thing when the servants of God were able to turn the Nile to blood, at least blood color. That was a stab at the heart of everything that was there. And all of the and this is one good thing that Davis does. He points out the plague of the gnats, the plague of the lice, all relate to the gods of Egypt. And it was God literally saying, I will win against the gods of Egypt. And thus the title of the book, Moses and the Gods of Egypt. And it's all about this area here. Now notice Israel coming into the picture. I'll take this off. Which is coming down right here. Cover that heavily. Israel is literally a land bridge. Because when you come over here, you're in Europe. And the armies of Europe marched across Palestine over and over again. Down here is Africa. And the trade routes and the armies marched from Africa across Palestine over and over again. And then, of course, over in here, you have a continent of Asia. So literally, Palestine is called the land bridge, where the armies of Asia would march across Palestine into Africa. Africa would march north. Europe, the nations of Europe, would cross the land bridge here, and that's one of the miracles of history. The narrowest place through which you could march in Palestine was 57 miles. In biblical times, the trade routes all went in this particular direction. Hopefully, we'll have time to trace out in Palestine the trade routes, because they're very significant for Old Testament history. Now, very important to us, then, would be, geographically, what are the boundaries of the Promised Land? And let's go to the passage that deals with the boundaries of the Promised Land, Genesis 15. Huh. Oh, here it is. Genesis 15. If Israel is the promised land, obviously it would be nice to know what its boundaries are. And we want to do something with the boundaries of Palestine. Genesis 15, 18. This is the key passage on the promised land. And notice in this passage that the boundaries are expressed in terms of the people who occupy it. So verse 18. On that day the Lord God made a covenant with Abram, saying, to the descendants I have given this land. And the rest of the verses are defining its boundaries. But notice they're defined in terms of the people that reside there. From the river of Egypt, note that in your mind because that's a problem. From the river of Egypt, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. Now, on a map, it's easy to find the Euphrates. And he is describing a southern boundary. Let me get this wiped off of here. Nancy, can you get me a little wet something, towel? Thank you. Okay. Now, the first problem is, here is the Euphrates. And we'll just put a star there. Over to the river of Egypt. From the river of Egypt. Now, that can mean one of two things. It can mean that the boundary is the Nile. Is the river of Egypt the Nile? Yes, it could be. But there's also another river called El Arish that comes in right here. It's not on this map. But El Arish and River of Egypt are hard to distinguish. Now, what that means, and it's a major problem, and when Israel gets the land, how much will she get? If you hold to the river, Nile River idea, then the promised land will not be obtained by Israel until you get all the way down to the Nile. Some, and this is a matter of liberal versus conservative, many conservative scholars feel that it is not all the way to the Nile, but over to El Arish. So there is option one and option two for that boundary. And it's not an easy problem. I don't have it solved in my own mind enough to say it is for sure one of these. But there is probably one 200-mile difference between that boundary. This is not in question. Now, what about the rest of it? From the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. That's marking it by geography. But notice he now begins to mark off the land of Canaan, or the promised land, by its inhabitants. And you have the Kenite, the Kenizzite, the Kadmonite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, and the Rephaim, the Amorite, and the Canaanite, and the Jergesite, and the Jebusite. Now that assumes that we know who these tribes were and exactly where they were located. We do know the following, and the following is pretty much a matter of history, much a matter of fact. The Amorites occupied the Fertile Crescent, the Canaanite area around 2000 BC. We do know that they were they practiced child sacrifice. We have pictures on the tombs. Sesostris' tomb has pictures of them richly dressed, highly cultured, making child sacrifice. They were part of the promised land. The Canaanites, we do know, were coastal dwellers. The Perizzites, the Kadmonites, I can't find anybody that knows exactly who these people were. But these determine north and south borders so that would go roughly in here, to here, to here, in this fashion. Biblically defined, as you well can see, Israel has anything but occupied the promised land. The closest ever to come to it was in the time of Solomon. And Solomon pretty much conquered for Israel, the land that God had promised. Never has it been fully occupied by Israel as promised by God. So while it might seem easy to define the boundaries of the promised land as God promised them, it's a little difficult. But roughly, that's what we have out of the key passage that's there. And again, just frankly, the Kadmonites, who were they? Where did they live? It's just a historical blank, and we really can't cross that bridge.
Would it be too much to show us what it is today, where everything is today?
No. Okay, the northern boundary is pretty good, but it's unsettled because of Lebanon. Lebanon, and that's a touchy border on that side. The banks of the Jordan, the west bank, is always a battleground as to who occupies that. Down to the south, Israel has given up as far as Jericho. And that's no way, and that's a long ways from Jericho up to Egypt. And they put Jericho, or Jericho itself is in Arab control, is it not? They put that in their control. I don't understand what's happening. These people fought and bled and died for this piece of territory. Well, I think that, but there could be a prophetic aspect to it. Is it, remember, as smart as Israel is, what's the last chapter about making agreements with other nations? She's going to make one with the Antichrist. He's going to break it. He's going to violate the temple. You could assume from that that maybe part of that delusion is settling on Israel right now. Because, I have a t-shirt at home that I love. It says, Israel is I-S-R-E-A-L. Israel is real. And they have been known for the realism that we are hanging on for dear life to this land. Through agreement and pressure, a good portion of that down in Jericho has been given up. I see that as still an absolute powder keg. Could just literally blow apart because you still have people. I haven't listened to anything or anyone. Oh, well, there's going to be. And it is volatile. Here's a land where when you go throughout it since the War of Liberation in 67, you'll go along and here's an old milk truck over at the side of the road. You go on up and here's an old beat up car. They're all national monuments to when our grandmothers went out literally with brooms. Anything you could pick up to win that country back in 1967. And those things are left to remind the young people that your great-grandmother shed her blood at this spot for that. And all over the country were war memorials to that effect. I remember we were there on the anniversary of that war. And I remember meeting a young Jewish kid out in the farm. And he was 18. And we got to talking, and he said, I got up one morning and flew my jet aircraft loaded with bombs 200 feet over the Mediterranean, dumped my load in Egypt, flew back, and was in the fields the next day. And that's always the neat thing about Israel. They don't consult anybody. They just do it. And by the time they bombed Egypt, the Security Council members are waking up and saying they did what? And that's typical of these people. The militant spirit that was there in just after that war, what an exciting thing to see a 17-year-old high school girl with her books and her automatic weapon. Should be taken away from her. Automatic weapon across the other shoulder. Ready at a split second. To go to war. And they've been militant like that. But I'm puzzled.
Could it be that there's so few recognized Jews in what there were, and there's so many breaks in their own religion, that maybe they
Well, that's true. But even there, you had different stripes of Jews militant. All the way to... Betty got... escorted out of part of Palestine by two Hasidic Jews because she was dressed like you. I can see 2 inches below your neck. Extremely rigid and strict. Ted and Jane, I remember, were at the temple of the Dome of the Rock, and they were going in, and she took his arm, as we would, and think nothing of it, and was stopped immediately. That's improper conduct. So you have that real strong Pharisaic group still remaining there. But why they're giving away their land is a mystery to me. I interpret it as perhaps a delusion that is the prelude to what we see of making a covenant, breaking the covenant in 3.5 years. There seems to be that kind of viewpoint. Now, let's take the land itself. And this is really geography that you really need to know if you're going to get any grasp of Palestine. This is the Mediterranean Sea, and this is the coastline of Israel. This is Galilee, this is the Jordan, and this is the Dead Sea. Now remember, we told you last night that you cannot learn geography merely from a geography book. You have to have photographs of it, and the reason we explain by putting up this overhead. We're going to go in this region right here, the Jordan Valley. And while it looks like fairly even, an actual photograph of it shows this to be the case of the Jordan River. You cannot go down it in a raft. It is innavigable. There are no boats, no ships of any sort on the Jordan because it is simply too dangerous. You would never make it from the top down. And I forget the mileage that from the upper lake to the Dead Sea is not much over 60 miles. But I would say you probably at least triple that if you follow the course of the Jordan. And notice that here are the hills of Moab, down in that direction, and here the Jordan goes on down to the Dead Sea, and it's not on here, but it's serpentine all the way, so that if you would go down on a boat, you'd be going north sometimes, south sometimes, east sometimes, west sometimes, and other times a compass reading sometime in between. So keep in mind that your map of the Jordan is not that helpful. All right, Mediterranean, and now here's the land. The land is divided into four areas. The first one is the coastal plain. Coastal plain. The coastal plain goes from the western boundary of Palestine, which is the Mediterranean Sea, and goes inward slightly. This can go anywhere from perhaps 8 miles in. The thing that marks the difference is you begin to get into the from the coastal plain, you begin to move inward to the hill country, so that it starts up here, and the first significant thing you come to is right here. Here is the only natural harbor in Palestine. It's Mount Carmel. Only natural harbor, Mount Carmel. South of it, you recall in the scripture hearing mention of Sharon, or the plain of Sharon. The plain of Sharon is just to the south, and it moves inward anywhere from 6 miles to a maximum of 12 miles. Now, in ancient time, the significance of the plain of Sharon was it was heavily wooded and had some very valuable land. Isaiah 35, 1 and 2. Isaiah 35, 1 and 2. Isaiah 35, 1 and 2. Now here again is the value of geography, that once again, the message depends on your understanding geography. He's describing where Israel will ultimately be. The wilderness and the desert will be glad. And certainly down in the south, they knew what the desert was like. I think the most miserable trip I ever took is, for some reason, we went down from Jerusalem to Egypt by a bus. And it was 100 and 200, 340 degrees. You just ate sand all of the way. The poverty. You come to the Suez Canal. And wow, I always think of the Suez Canal as really quite a thing. Someone said we're at the Suez. And here was a barge, a Missouri River barge, ready to take the bus across the Suez. It's like, you ever heard of Allenby Bridge in the southern Palestine? That's a one-lane wooden. Once you see the land, everything you've heard about and thought about and visualized is wrong. Every single concept about Palestine I had when I went first there in 1969 was absolutely shattered. Just totally different than what you thought it was. But the wilderness and the desert will be glad. The araba, that is the desert, will rejoice and blossom like the crocus. He will blossom profusely and rejoice with rejoicing and the shout of joy. By the way, in the library, there's a journey through Palestine with some of the most beautiful photography of that land that I've ever seen. It's by Hal Lindsay. And I'll try to remember to pull out and lay it on the table down there. But what a magnificent job of photography in Palestine he did, or whoever he worked with did. Then the last two lines, the glory of Lebanon. Lebanon is a Hebrew word meaning white. And it's for this part of Palestine up here. And it's called white because of the snow on Mount Lebanon. And the majesty of Carmel. And what does that say to us? The majesty of Carmel is the majesty of Mount Carmel. But since we've never seen it, we don't even know what to think, do we? And not only the majesty of Carmel, but the majesty of Sharon. Absolutely gorgeous, beautiful places. And I would encourage you, if you ever get a chance, one of the best educations you can ever get in the Scripture is go to Palestine and see some of these things. I will never forget the experience I shared with you about the sheep. Never forget looking down from a hotel room at probably 300 or 400 sheep following this little tyke. He couldn't have been over 6 years old. And man, that kid would whistle and bring those sheep, and it was just almost as though they were attached to him. And you get a shepherd idea. I remember going out one night in Bethlehem in the fields of Boaz, and you have never seen a night until you've seen a Palestinian night. That sky is so black and the stars are so bright. There isn't any smog. And we don't realize how much our sky, even though Kansas City has clean air, how much it's obscured. None of us know what night's like. Can you imagine a night with no lights? None. None at all. And I sat out there and read the account of the birth of when the angels appeared here. I read it midnight. And the light of the stars and the moon was sufficient to read. And you get that feel, and you can imagine what happened when the chorus of angels burst into the sky. And by the way, I might add this, you can't do good Bible study without imagination. You've got to be able to recreate and to go back there and see this this gorgeous thing. But Mount Carmel is significant in another way. It is the start of the only east-west valley in Palestine. The Valley of Esdraelon, or as we would know it in the New Testament, the Valley of Megiddo. And thus, the scene of Armageddon. And you can clearly see, if you ever visit it, through that valley from the inland out to the sea. And it's the only place that gives you an east-west valley as far as Palestine is concerned. And then you sit there and you look at that valley. You remember the prophecy of Revelation with the horrible battle that takes place there, with the blood coming up on the bodies of the horses, and you get a picture that you never, never forget. So that if you've been there, you can say, I know what Armageddon looks like. I've seen the battlefield. Not like George Patton looking over his shoulder to Roman times, but like the prophets of the New Testament and the Old Testament saw it. That's a significant landmark as far as it is concerned. Revelation 16:16, it's called Esdraelon or Megiddo, or Revelation 16:16 called Armageddon. Now, when you come down here into this portion, you are down to biblical Philistia. And I'll put below Philistia, the boundaries are a barometer. Because as you leave Philistia, the coastal part there, where the Philistines were located, when you leave it, you begin to get into what they call the Shephelah. And that is the foothills that leads on into deeper into Palestine. So let's... I'll make a squiggly line. And the squiggly line is the Shephelah. And when you want to see the condition of... they were foothills. Just not even Ozark size. Well, approximately Ozark size. Foothills. And when Israel was obedient, she dominated the foothills. When Israel was disobedient, the Philistines dominated the foothills. And so it's an interesting barometer to take up a chart and put the map down every 100 years and then match it with the history, and you'd see it. Obedient, disobedient, obedient, disobedient, obedient. And so this was a touchstone in the southern part of Palestine. Now, if we go from the... we begin here to get hills, all right? And when you begin to get hills... you have the second part. First part is coastal. The second part is the central range. Central range of Palestine. And it extended from the foothill area almost over to the Jordan River, but not quite. Mount Lebanon up here. 10,000 feet. Down here, a short distance, the deepest place, the biggest geological rift on the earth in the Dead Sea. There is no rift. Let's see, we've got, what do we have in Missouri? We've got the, what rifts do we have around here? Sierra Madres. It's California, right? New Madrid in Missouri. And I don't know how our United States, you know, you look at, anytime I call California, I ask if you've broken off into the sea yet. Because of that rift that's out there. And of course, they've had some good tremors with that moving around. There is the rift to watch. Right through Palestine. Biggest one in the world. And therefore, if you know that geography a little bit, when prophecy talks about the Mount of Olives splitting in two, big deal. That could certainly happen without any problem. But geologically and prophetically, here is the earthquake possibility. That is very, very great. You start up here at 10,000 feet, and remember, it's then divided into Galilee, Samaria, and then down to Judea. Northern Galilee, up here, coming down from Mount Carmel, runs anywhere from 2,800 to 4,000 feet above sea level. Then you move from that mountain range. And by the way, in here would be the mountains and hills of Judah, where David did a lot of hiding, significant area. Here would be Jerusalem, right about in this area. And then you come over to this area, which is called the Jordan Valley. The Jordan Valley is the deepest depression and the most remarkable geological phenomena on the earth. And if you're into geography or into this type of thing, then there it is right there. Nothing matches this as far as geography is concerned. The sources of the Jordan, and we're talking now about a 60-mile straight as the crow flies journey. The Jordan, the sources of the Jordan up here are about 1,200 feet. They drop to the Dead Sea in a matter of 60 miles to negative 1292. And I don't know a lot about this sort of thing, but dropping off from 1,200 through the land for 60 miles and being 1,292 below sea level, and that's the surface of the Dead Sea. And if you go on down to the bottom of the Dead Sea, you need to add to that another 1,300 feet, plus 1,300 feet to the bottom. There is no land like it. Literally no land like Palestine. Look at a couple of passages. Let's relate this to Jeremiah 12:5. Jeremiah 12 and verse 5. And let me back off for just a second and make a comment. Here is the uniqueness, one of the unique features of Christianity, biblical Christianity, is it takes place in space and time. You take all of your Eastern religions, and they're not space and time religions. They're mystical. You smell incense. You feel things. And the whole thing is a mystical experience. Can you think of any book that is more time and space? Why you have, you know, the remark that such and such happened at such and place as you go up the road to AI? How's that for being time and space? We know where Jesus died, in Jerusalem. We know how he died on a cross, a real cross. And literally, Christianity is God walking right into history and says, I'm going to go down to Jericho. And you know that road that leads up this way from Jericho? I'm going to walk one of my prophets up that road. You know that road where over on the left is a certain kind of an oak tree? You know the place? It is literally God incarnate when you study, and this is totally different. Can you give the geography of Hinduism? It doesn't make any difference. Of Islam, you have your Medinas, you have your places to which you make your pilgrimage, but and some of the drama of it. Now I've seen this, and therefore I can sense it. Jesus, on the way to Jerusalem, went to Bethany, and they stayed all night. They then went across, and Bethany is on the eastern slope of the Mount of Olives. And you can be 10 miles away from Jerusalem at Bethany, and you can't see it. It's invisible, because you're coming up to Bethany. He stayed all night at Bethany. And I've done this and I've seen it. You come up from Bethany And you walk up to a certain place on the ridge, and all of a sudden, the whole of Jerusalem opens up in front of you. And it's just, it's one of those things where you gulp, because you're going up a mountain, you haven't been on the road very long, and all of a sudden this all bursts open in front of you. It's like seeing Los Angeles from a cockpit of an airplane. The Sierra Madres, you're flying along and you look out, it's only black. Then all of a sudden, the whole west coast of San, and it's almost a strip town, of Los Angeles, strip city I should say, all the way down, and you just gasp because the city bursts on your sight. Well, in Jerusalem, which was about 25,000 people in the times of Jesus, it was Passover, which means all the Jewish males and families and caravans had come down to the Passover at Jerusalem. Some estimates were that the city of 25,000 people would become 1 million people all over the city. And Jesus comes up the hill to Bethany. They leave. They come over the top of the Mount of Olives. He sees the city of Jerusalem, and he bursts into sobs. And there he says, "Oh, how it would have gathered you, Jerusalem," as he sees the maybe as much as 1 million. Some say that as many as 1 million people saw the crucifixion in some form at that time, because the city, again, was swollen with pilgrimage from Galilee. That was the one time of year that the Herod would come down from his home on Caesarea, because he couldn't stand Jews. But Jews got really, really high around Passover time, and they felt strong as they were gathered together, and they thought, well, I believe we can throw off Rome. So there was always a detachment of at least 100,000 Roman soldiers sent down from Caesarea to camp in Jerusalem to be sure everything kept quiet and there are no riots. And it was to that throng and of crowds that Jesus looks, and he sees the crowds. Some of the crowd sees him, and they start out as he descends the Mount of Olives. They start up the Mount of Olives, and as you would go out the east, you would go down into the valley, you would go through the Garden of Gethsemane, and you would start up the Mount of Olives. Not Mount of Olives, Mount Hill. And you would you start up through, it's walkable, and the crowds come out waving, remember the palm branches, and the crowd meets the crowd that's with Jesus, and they join and march into Jerusalem. The geography of it, it is the most dramatic possible scene that you could ever imagine. Some of the drama is taken out of it today, because right on top of Mount of Olives is a grand, beautiful international hotel. And throughout Palestine, on many of these places, it gets a little discouraging, because everybody and his brothers built a church on it. They will show you on the top of the Mount of Olives a place in the dirt that they preserved that looks like someone went like that. You know what that is? That's the footprint of Jesus as he ascended. I mean, he kind of launched himself. And that's his footprint right there. There it is. You've seen it. Put a quarter in the kettle, because you've seen the footprint. And, of course, that's nonsense. And there's a lot of that. But if you can get around it, you can see the Pool of Siloam. The Pool of Siloam is rather deep. And when you go to a place like Palestine, you have to remember that unlike Kansas City, you get in Europe where they've got thousands of years of histories, and you have these things called tells. Tell, Armana, and it means city level one, armies march, push it to the ground, build new city, city level two, armies march across, burn it to the ground, rebuild it, city level number three. And so in archaeology, it's just like slicing a cake, and they go down through these various levels. This this man's name? Was it Leakey? I don't know, but pretty good evidence that they probably found the flood. Because an archaeologist was going down and down and down, and all of a sudden, at a certain level, he hit silt and went through 6 feet of silt. Now, how did 6 feet of silt get there? And then you know what happened when he got on the other side of it? Back to civilization and pottery. So you had artifacts, 6 foot break of silt, and artifacts again. And he was not searching for this, but he did very generously say, it looks as though some water has been here. So the flood level may have been discovered. But this was true with cities also. Now, if you see the Pool of Siloam, you would naturally, okay, and then here, let's say, is present Jerusalem. Make it level 4. And they don't necessarily thin out like that. I've exaggerated it too much. But, okay, here's the current. And we're going to go and walk down the streets of Palestine. This is the street of Palestine. And we're going to see the Pool of Siloam. So what is the dumb American doing? Who has no sense of history? He's looking around. I don't see it down there. And the guide says, you have to look straight down. Because they've excavated down and down and down and down. And down here on level 1 or whatever level is the Pool of Siloam. And you say, well, did they plant it 50 feet in the ground? No, that's just the way it is over there. They built city on city on city on city. And that's probably probably valid, that is truly the Pool of Siloam. The other valid thing that you can see down at many levels in one church is you have, and they, when the church was built there, it was much later that they went down and found this. But you do find tile floors with games in the tile. That could be very well the place or the type of thing that the soldiers gambled for or threw dice for Jesus' garment. So there's a lot to see in Palestine. If you'll forget the stinky churches and all that, we can probably go to the place where Jesus was born, literally. But it's in a church. The opening is about that high. You have to bend down, go down many steps, and you get down there, and there is incense and oil and religious paraphernalia and bells and priests all over the place. But it is likely that back into that cave, you do have the original birthplace of Jesus. Now, of course, with all the religion encrusted, it takes something away. But if you can get away around from that, then you probably are able to see some very authentic things as far as the life of Christ is concerned in Palestine. Okay, the Jordan River, then, is extremely important. Geographically, and we were stopping at Jeremiah 12, were we not, verse 5. Now, in this Jordan Rift, this is all vegetation. And it's vegetation like in Africa. And yes, there are lions, there are bears, there's wildlife, there are snakes. It's like taking a safari in the jungle to go down the Jordan River Rift. Almost impassable. It is so grown over, almost impassable. Now, if you'd seen that, and this helps a little bit, can you imagine getting caught in among this vegetation and trying to get out? Jeremiah 12:5. If you've run with footmen and they have tired you out, then how can you compete with horses? If you fall down in a land of peace, how will you do in the thicket of Jordan? and the thicket of Jordan was simply saying, we'll take you from Jerusalem for your sin and throw you over here in the thicket, and there's no way you'll ever get out. It's worse than being pursued by an army. It's worse than being pursued by horses. You are stuck, and you won't get out. And that was a vivid, vivid message to them. 49:19. Now, in that thicket, you had a lot of African-type wildlife. And so, in 49:19, behold, one will come up like a lion from the thicket of Jordan. And since we've never seen the thicket of Jordan, what was your original picture of Jordan? What a beautiful little flowing stream. You can walk down to it and you can stick your finger in Jordan. You'd either get caught in the thicket or getting eaten alive in that thicket, because that's the nature of it. And so in 49:19, behold, one will come up like a lion from the thicket of Jordan. And these were people who had seen lions come out of the thicket of Jordan. Against a perennially watered pasture, for in an instant I will make him run away from it, and whoever is chosen I will appoint him, and so forth and so forth. And that's all out of the geography of this particular place. Again, if you ever visit Palestine, every man on God's earth, I think, is an opportunist, aren't we? And they will sell you a little bottle of Jordan River water. And if you keep it for over a year, it stinks to high heaven. We threw our Jordan water away. But again, it is a land of opportunists. And they will sell you anything and everything. And they have no promise, no problem with the Mideast premise. Is you start with a lie and work to truth. It's the way they do. That's their culture. That's why it's hard for us. You go in and you want to buy a Coke. All you want is a Coke. How much do you want for the Coke? $20. No. And you go to 15 and 10. And you finally get the man to be honest. And he'll sell it to you for a reasonable... They always start with a lie. Always. I had one try to sell me... I was walking one night in Cairo. And it was well after midnight. And a little apprehensive anyway, because the Arabian people are not... they're gray. Deep gray face and piercing eyes. And I came to one, I just stole over by the Sphinx, and one comes up to me, President Reagan will be here tomorrow, he's going to visit, and he's going to be here, save you a seat, right here, save you a seat for $25. And you got to know, of course he's lying. That's all they know is the lie. And that's where they always start, with the lie. And you finally, that's a good definition of what it means to barter. Bartering is working from the lie to the truth. What they want for it and what you really get for it. And that's the way everything's carried on in that way. And that's why you can become victim of opportunistic people. Especially when they're little children. How about it, Floyd? Floyd had all the children of Jerusalem following after him because he was a pretty soft touch. And you just have to learn when a little Arab kid comes up and he tugs on your pants and looks with great big black eyes and Penny, you have to say, get out of here, kid, and you have to kick him off your pads. Hey, it almost gets that way. You know, it almost, that's an exaggeration. But if you go over there with a heart, man, you won't last 2 days. You come back without a nickel. And the good old Americans, you know, feed the world, help everybody, be nice to the poor, and you just see them stripped of their money by the beggar. In biblical times, we don't have time to go to it. You know what one of the most profitable businesses in Palestine was? a beggar. And yet we say, oh, the poor beggar. Poor beggar's making more money in one day than you make. Remember the report here in Kansas City that was at KMZ or one station that made, found out that some of the street people standing down here on Broadway took in as much as $3,000 and $4,000 a day?
Yeah.
And the poor, big-hearted person goes by and you're embarrassed because you're driving a nice car. And you feel guilty because you've got a nice car. So you drop money in their pot. And he's made more than you made all week. I always want to say, stick out your foot so I can run over it. But nonetheless, there's big business in that. And it's profitable. Especially if you could find a place up near the temple. Because one part of the Jewish people earning their way into heaven is alms. And man, if you can pretend to have a cut off leg or pretend to be blind, every Jew that goes in, it's going to say, well, see, I probably haven't given too well. I got to pray and get things squared away with God. So he empties his pockets in your bag. Big money. So that some of the people that were healed by Jesus began to face immediate financial problems because they literally had to give up their means of living when he healed them. Okay, from this, we go across to the fourth part of Palestine, coastal plain, central plain, the Jordan Valley, and now the final eastern range, the eastern range. Now, coming out here, you've got a couple of rivers. One of them coming out of here is called Yarmouk. And it's important to note that because if you went from way up here, this is Lake Hula, from this distance here, in this particular distance, it is called Bashan. And Bashan was known for its cattle, for its bulls. And therefore, in Psalm 22, verse 12, and two passages we need to look at. Psalm 22, verse 12. Jesus is speaking about, in figurative terms, about those who surround him on the cross. And he says, many bulls have surrounded me. Strong bulls of Bashan have encircled me. And he was referring to the magnificent cattle up in this region of Palestine. And for the reader, they know what a bull of Bashan is. And I can't really come up with something real quick. Maybe you can. You know any particular cattle that are known to be predominant in certain parts of our country? Texas Longhorns. And that's a good one because I remember the first time when I was a kid I ever went to Texas and saw a Texas Longhorn. I was just amazed because that didn't look like the cows we had in our field. It was magnificent. And the Texas Longhorn would be somewhat what like the bulls of Bashan were. When you come down south of the Yarmouk in this particular direction, this is called the land of Gilead. And Gilead was known for medicinal balm. Jeremiah 8:22. Jeremiah 8:22. Dave, will you get me a hymn book from back in the stack there? Okay, Jeremiah 8 and verse 22. Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? Why then has not the health of the daughter of my people been destroyed? And to say, is there no balm in Gilead, is to say, is there no healing? Because Gilead was, was associated with healing. Look at chapter 46. Go up to Gilead and obtain balm. O virgin daughter of Egypt, in vain you have multiplied remedies. There is no healing for you. And it's simply saying, come into the land of God's people and you will receive the healing for your soul that you need. And how many times have you sung this? I'm looking at in our hymn book at number 423. There is a balm in Gilead. You recognize the song? There is a balm in Gilead to make the wounded whole. There is a balm in Gilead to heal the sin-sick soul. And it's a hymn built around Gilead. And that was associated with healing in the minds of God's people. By the way, up in this area, there was a mountain called Nebo. Right in here was Mount Nebo. And from Mount Nebo, remember how that's significant geographically? Moses got up on Nebo and put his hands over his eyes and he squinted and he looked. And he saw the promised land that he would never inherit. And so those places become highly significant. Geography is important. Whenever you see a place, always find out where the place is if you possibly can. In connection with that, geography, what comes to your mind? Gettysburg. Do you just picture the city? Or does a whole flood come back? A whole flood of memory comes back. Shechem. Nothing. Man, that's got a flood of history behind it that's unbelievable. 38th parallel. Is that a geographical location? Yeah, it is. Is that all there is to it? Nam. Just a place? Certain longitude and latitude? Why does it get called? Why it's not Vietnam? Why is it Nam? And it was only Nam after the war there. And so when places are mentioned, we'll do one with Jerusalem. And we'll just go down about a dozen events that took place in Jerusalem. And all of a sudden, though we know it, it begins to loom very large in our minds, the tremendous significance any time you said Jerusalem for the Jewish folks. These four planes are essential. And again, if you want to do a study in geography and get a country that has more variety to it, more of everything in it, go to Palestine. Most significant place geographically, spiritually, on God's earth. And it is interesting that long after the Old and the New Testament, this little teeny land, is it still in the news? Almost every day, isn't it? What happens here makes a difference. I frankly don't understand when I study the trade routes. I don't know how this little place ever made it. It just couldn't grow much grass when you got armies from Europe and Asia and Africa tromping over your land all the time. And yet it has survived. I think from the geographical standpoint alone, the survival of Israel is a miracle. Consider nothing but just geography. It's a miracle. Rocky place, and yet it's going to blossom like a rose. There's a saying in Israel that when an angel flew over Israel, he had a bag of rocks, and the bag burst over Israel. And a rocky land, and yet I have never been any place in my life where, as a Christian, your heart is left. just every rock and stone is it tears at you. To go up and sit on the shore of Galilee and the hills, to watch a thunderstorm build up over Galilee, just churn that thing up like you wouldn't believe, and then just quickly turn off. And then to picture that it was in that scene that Jesus, in a boat being tossed all over the place, is asleep. The disciples wake him up, and he says, literally, be muzzled, and the waters settle. It's an unforgettable, and I'm not trying to sell a trip to Israel. We may do one. One of the problems with that is the airfare right now is almost more than your food and lodging in Israel. And I have had a little apprehension because they gave all this land away. But boy, do they have the... Talk about having your ear to the ground. We were all ready to go to Nablus. And they said, no. And it was in the morning. They said, no, we're not going to Nablus this time because there's going to be an outbreak up there. And there was. How in the world those people knew it, I don't know. Don't count on what you read in the newspaper. I came back and kind of kept a diary and read what happened in Israel while we were over there. It did not. I was there. We'll talk about this great skirmish that broke out in a certain place. There wasn't any. But some, you know, so you have to remember, as you do, I think, in all things, never, ever, ever, ever believe the media. And I'm not saying they lie on purpose, but they lie on purpose, I think. And it's always garbled. Always garbled. Don't count on it for 1 minute. I gave one interview once to the Kansas City Star. I will never, ever, ever interview for any kind of article, even if I can write it myself, because they'll change it. So go light when you read those things in the newspaper, and especially when you get reports like that. We did have an interesting experience. Let's see, I don't think you guys were along this time, but we did have an interesting experience. Our bus driver was was an officer in the Israeli military, and we were on the way up to Nablus, and he stopped at a sign along the way, and an Arab spit on his bus. He shut that baby down, and he took off after the Arab. We never saw him again. We had to find another driver. But you're not going to spit on a Jewish bus. It just doesn't happen. That's the kind of spirit you often see there. Okay, that's sort of a flyover on geography and important things pertaining to it. Question? Yes. I'll have geography books stacked beginning for our... Give me a 5 minute break and let me spend the rest of our time, 15 minutes, on some books. And I'll stack them out here for you. Okay? So don't go too far. It's 3:25. In fact, if you can contain your bladder, just wait.